This is Comic Shenanigans, episode 1002, A Conversation with Mark Waid. Welcome to the Comic Shenanigans Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Chapman. This is episode 1002, A Conversation with Mark Waid. I've been very lucky over the years to have Mark grace this show to talk about comics and his work. This is actually the sixth episode. It's actually funny, I was looking back in preparation for this interview, and I didn't even realize that I had spoken to him basically from 2018 to now. I have had at least one episode in each calendar year. So if you want to go back and listen to some of his other appearances on the show, you can go back to episode 620, back from October 2018, where we're talking about Ruse, his work for CrossGen. Then you can go to episode 724, which is actually a joint conversation with him and Brian Augustin, who's unfortunately now passed away, where we talk about some of their work working on the Archie books together. That was November 2019. Then if you go to 2020, we had a conversation that went up, at least was posted April 20th that year, right at the beginning of the pandemic, episode 770. That one we talked about, you know, some of the impacts to the publisher that he was working for at the time. 2021, we have episode 872 that he came on board, and then in 2022 he was in episode 950. So you know, it's kind of crazy that even though I had the podcast gone for a year, I was still able to keep this this tradition alive. So I kind of joked to him afterwards, you know, that I'll be talking to him in 2024, I should say, to keep that streak going. But it's such a pleasure to be able to welcome Mark back to the Comic Shenanigans podcast. We talk about, it's funny, because when I first reached out to him, I was like, well, let's talk Sigil. Let's, you know, you worked on this book for 8 or 9 issues from CrossGen, and it's going to be reprinted as an omnibus soon. CrossGen was not his favorite point of his career for many reasons, so there's less maybe he remembers of that than I would have expected. But that being said, he's written so many books, worked on so many things. Not everything's going to matter or something, which is always what's so fascinating, right, about any piece of media, is that, you know, it could be someone's, you know, last track on an album that they just kind of threw on as a lark, and it was just like an experimentation, and that could be someone's favorite song forever. And it's really fascinating how that works. And that could be a song that that person didn't even think about anymore, but to that person who heard it, it was just life-changing. And I guess it is that way with comics too, right? That, you know, you have these random books sometimes that creators will do an issue of or fill in, and then it ends up being like, you know, a very seminal moment for that reader, which is, you know, really fascinating when there is that kind of interesting disconnect between the person creating the work and the person consuming it, that it could have such a different importance. It could also be, you know, someone could be working on their favorite thing ever, and then it, you know, does it lands with a thud, and then no one cares, which is equally heartbreaking, really. Anyways, thanks for downloading this episode. I don't know what led to this tangent, but I was so pleased to be able to talk with Mark again. He's had so much going on lately at DC Comics. It's almost like a Mark Waid renaissance. That it was really a lot of fun to be able to talk to him about it and all these different books that have kind of started from it. Because when I first had him on, well, not when I first had him on, when I had him on last year, which would have been, you know, early 2022, I think it was February, you know, he was gearing up to do his World's Finest run, but now he's got Shazam, he's got, you know, all these other books, The Last Days of Lex Luthor, you have the World's Finest Teen Titans, like, there's so many books he's working on, and it's really just exploded, and as a fan of his work, I could not be more pleased. Anyways, without further ado, let's get into the episode, but first, just one last piece of housekeeping. You can always email me at comicshenanigans@gmail.com. We did get a great email this past week, that my wife was very excited about, because it was it did include the hashtag needs more Kelly, which she always jokes about. So it was really nice to get that. So I just want to thank Johnny, for sending that email. It was really nice. Johnny from Denver, Colorado, sounds like something you would say on a radio show. But thank you so much for your very positive words. It was really great to get that email. That was one thing that Kelly and I had talked about on episode 1001 is, you know, is anyone still listening? You know, this podcast never had huge numbers. You know, it had a small but dedicated fan base, I'll call it. That's the way I like to think of it. But I put that episode up and, you know, it's been a week and, you know, right back to kind of where we were, if not a little bit better, for episodes that don't have an interview and it's really just me, you know, gabbing with my wife, and it did well. So it's really nice to know that people are still listening. And what I joked about in my response to Johnny was, you know, for a lot of people who have subscriptions to podcasts, you don't necessarily stop it when the podcast ends. You just kind of like, all right, because there's no new episodes. And you kind of leave that subscription on, and then suddenly a year later, you get an episode out of nowhere, which is kind of exciting. So anyways, without further ado, finally, let's get into this fantastic conversation with Mark Wade. Thank you for sticking with the Comic Shenanigans podcast. We have some great stuff coming up in the next few weeks, but in the meantime, let's jump right into this conversation with Mark Wade. Enjoy. Mark, welcome back to the Comic Shenanigans podcast.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, I was actually checking the records, and this would appear to be your sixth time on the show, and it's actually interesting. Apparently, every year since 2018, you've been on once.
Good Lord, I can't believe people are still interested in listening to what I have to say.
You know, I have often thought that if you just had your own podcast just talking about your own work, I would listen to that all the time. I find every interview with you extremely interesting. I just find your voice very pleasant to listen to, and you're such a born storyteller, not just obviously on the printed page, but also just in terms of speaking.
Well, thank you, sir. That's something I've been toying with lately. It's finding some way to do something that is, you know, podcast worthy and unique enough where it's not just, you know, Mark Wade blathers on. But I think there's something that could be done there. I'll keep you posted as I go forward.
Absolutely. And honestly, if it was just called Mark Wade Blathers On, you'd have a lot of people listening.
That's true. That's true. All right. Speaking of blathering on, let's get into it.
Absolutely. So, one of the things I did want to talk about, and then we'll get into some questions about current work. But I had realized that, you know, every time I have you on, I try to pick something from your vast body of work to kind of zero in on that I don't think a lot of people have talked about, that I just have some interest in having you hear about, or hearing you talk about, I should say. So for today, I thought I was really interested because there's an upcoming Sigil omnibus of the cross-gen series that Marvel's going to be putting out later this year. I'm actually surprised of all the books that CrossGen put out, I'm surprised that's the one that gets the omnibus treatment first. But
you're surprised. I'm stunned.
But I had forgotten, and shame on me, that you had written, I think, issues 12 to 19 or something in that span. So I was rereading them recently, and I was like, I got to talk to Mark about this because it's an interesting book. It's got a lot going on. It's got this kind of epic feeling to it. So I was just curious what it was like, first of all, to kind of come onto the book to replace Barbara. And then was it meant to be a longer run than just those, you know, 8 or 9 issues? Or was it always kind of planned that you would give it off to someone else? Like, I'm just curious what that period was like in particular with this book.
Well, let's start by reminding you that I have done everything I can to purge the cross-gen days out of my memory.
I know. So, I keep bringing it back.
That's okay. But all that said, look, you know, working with Scott Eaton was a plus. I mean, Scott's a great artist and a good guy. And so I don't remember why I took the keys from Barbara on that, but I do know that I never really felt comfortable with it. It's just, as a character, I really couldn't get much of a handhold on. I don't think. I mean, I haven't looked at that stuff since it was published, and I have no idea. I don't even know if I've got access to that stuff anywhere. So if it's any good at all, it's just blind luck. But I wish I could tell you more, but I remember literally nothing.
Okay. What is interesting to hear you talk about it, the fact that, you know, that you struggled to find a handhold on Samandal Ray as a character is interesting because in your run, you definitely expand. I mean, it was already kind of a wide tapestry in terms of what you could do with this. But it did feel like you were playing with a lot of other characters as well, and not just kind of putting the focus on him, because he was kind of the stoic leading man who was maybe difficult to zero in on. So you definitely got to play with the other supporting characters.
Well, there's also the fact that and I talk about this when I teach writing, is that it's important to find pieces of yourself in the characters, you know, not Mary Jane it up altogether, where it's, or Mary Sue it up altogether, rather, where it's, you know, just a Romana clay of you, but some, you know, some pieces of you in that character. And I, you know, we could not be further apart. You know, he's a hard bitten blue collar ex-military guy, and I'm Niles Crane, and I dust the chair before I sit down. So it was, so I think that was the difficult part. But I'm glad that it worked. I'm glad that it's, you didn't feel like you wasted your time. I just, but I'm like you. I cannot, I am gobsmacked that of all of the books they could choose, and this is no reflection on Scott Eaton because he is awesome, but of all, and Barbara's good too. And, you know, it, but it was definitely the solid double of the lineup as opposed to, you know, some of the other material that I think was really stunning.
Yeah, I kind of always thought that, you know, Ruse obviously would be one of the ones I would put up on the list of something that would be, you know, a good omnibus because, you know, it is relatively self-contained. It doesn't have a lot of connections to the grander universe. Obviously, they're there, but they're not as prevalent as they are in a book like Sizzle. Even a book like Scion, which boasts stunning artwork and amazing colors by Justin Ponser. Yeah, you know, there's books like those that seem to be a bit more... you know, kind of on their own. Also, Meridian was kind of a really good, you know, female empowerment book. It was a really strong female lead. I always thought those books would probably have been the ones to get an omnibus before Sigil because it felt more tied into the overall tapestry of what Crossgen was trying to do, which is harder to, you know, show modern audiences who maybe didn't weren't around reading back then.
Right. And Sigil, and again, I will say this one more time because I cannot underscore it enough. I have nothing but respect for Scott Eaton, and I think he is a great artist. But, and this is not, this has nothing to do with him. But the other thing that's bizarre about it is that that's, that book looks like everything else that's being published today. I mean, it's not, that's, a, you know, there's other books that we did that are just, they look, you know, they have their own distinct look to them, their own distinct style. And this, this, I don't know. It's, anyway, I, the people working on it were exemplary. And it is not their fault that I don't think it really, the book really came together the way that some of the other books did.
Now, last one of the last questions I'll ask you about this period before I kind of bring us away from CrossGen is, you know, working on this book, you also did, I think, a Sorion Selection miniseries, and you also launched Crux around this time. Do you have fonder memories of those projects?
I do. I certainly, here's my memory of Crux. My memory of Crux is I was at home taking a personal day, and I got a call at 2 p.m. And for some reason, you know, from, I got it from Mark Alessi, and for some reason that escapes me, it was a red alert. We had to have a book on the stands now. Like, we needed a new book figured out today. And I literally came up with every character in that book while I was driving from my house to the office.
Well, so it never felt that way.
Thank you, because I think that some of them are about as deep as a bottle cap. But I think that, you know, some of the other stuff I think worked together. I love writing twins, which is why I hit that beat again in Irredeemable. But yeah, I, you know, it worked. Look, and again, Steve Epting. I mean, you could put anything on that page, and it would be a great comic because it's Steve Epting.
Definitely a gorgeous book. Speaking of Irredeemable, so since our last conversation, obviously Boom originally ran a Kickstarter, and then now they're actually kind of releasing the deluxe editions of Irredeemable and Incorruptible. What was it like to see it get redone in this format, and do you think this is your preferred format for the book, or did you like the original kind of larger omnibus printings?
Actually, they've done a beautiful job with putting these things out in these Kickstarter hardcover editions. That is absolutely my preferred way of having that material. They did softcover versions as a sort of a compendia that came out in stores a few weeks earlier that are fine. But again, I always worry with a 2,000-page book that it's not going to survive the read physically. But yeah, this the stuff they did at Kickstarter, the hardcover they did, I hope that when everybody has got their rewards, when all the Kickstarter stuff has been fulfilled, which they're in the middle of doing now, I hope that when all the dust settles, they find a way to reissue the hardcovers in a mass market way, because I think they're just gorgeous looking.
What do you think of that business model? I mean, you've been on the business end, so I'm curious what your take is on a company like Boom doing a Kickstarter like this to get product like that. It's kind of, again, more premium than they end up kind of putting through the at least the original distribution channels. How do you feel about that just from the business perspective?
I'm okay with it. I remember the first time that a company did it was Archie Comics, and it was a huge, huge outcry from people who were angry that a corporation, you know, a company was coming in and doing what individuals were doing to support. And I got why they were upset at the time, but looking back on it and seeing how much, you know, other people, you know, Jimmy Palmiotti has made an industry out of it for himself, God bless him, and what can be accomplished in Kickstarter. Kickstarter was a much different thing back then when Archie did their thing. And it's metamorphed into like a legitimate distribution channel for the kind of things that you would not normally be able to sell in a comic store. I know when I was publisher at Humanoids, we had at least one project that, because it was so slow going, it would have sold reasonably well when it was commissioned, but by the time it finally came out, or was, you know, finally finished rather, I thought that our best bet was going to be to go to Kickstarter and do something with it, and that didn't happen for whatever reason. But I have no issue with it at this point. I think that, you know, enough people have taken bites of that apple where it's not a huge PR black eye for a company to jump on board the Kickstarter wagon at this point.
That's a good point. I hadn't really thought about that. You're right. It has definitely, the market has definitely matured in that way. Because I remember that outcry before. But yeah, like, I don't see anyone, no one says anything about them now. So I guess they're just becoming more commonplace.
Right. I think that you've got, you know, you also have Indiegogo as, you know, working with a lot of other solo creators. So there's another outlet. At the time, Kickstarter was the only game in town. So, you know, I understand from a publishing point of view, every once in a while you want to put out a product that you know there is a market for, but there is not a large enough market to make it a mass market product. So, and I've always been behind the crowdfunding model in general. I mean, I've been for it for 25 years because I've always said that if you're smart, what you do is you create through social media and through your product, you create your own fan base that will then follow you wherever you go and will be constantly there for you. Because, and people like that. People enjoy knowing that they're giving their money straight to the person who's making the music or making the words or making the art, as opposed to giving it to Sony, who will then take their piece and then give a smaller piece to the content creator, right? People enjoy the direct channel of it. The only drawback is the time it takes to, between, you know, issuing your check and having your credit card billed and getting the product. That is the only, that's the only downside to this. And I don't know how you solve that, but I have been a big fan of this forever. You know, but you've heard of the Kiss Army, yes?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I use as my model all the time. I mean, for those who don't understand, I mean, Kiss, the band, did such a great job of this in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. They built their fan base to what they call the Kiss Army, and they are, you know, hundreds of thousands strong. And again, at that, up until, you know, the band really kind of semi-retired, you could count on that. They could count on those people to buy every piece of merch, every CD, every anything, and that's invaluable.
Absolutely. I guess you still have that in the modern era too, but in music, you have, like, you know, the Swifties, fans of Taylor Swift, like, they'll show up in droves, and if you can cultivate that, it's, you know, it makes everything work.
Yeah, I wish I'd done a better job of it. I look back on the last like 10, 15 years of my career, and I wish I'd done a better job of sort of trying to cultivate and organize a fan base rather than just using social media to punch Nazis.
I mean, that's invaluable too, but you don't you don't think you have a group of, you know, for lack of a better term, weighties out there who are like, go Mark Wade?
Maybe, but they're, you know, they're scant. They're the odd ducks in their hometown. You know, they're, I love them. I don't know if there's enough of them to carry me should I go do like an original graphic novel Kickstarter or Indiegogo project. I don't know that there's enough of them out there that would be able to carry me, just because I haven't organized them very well over the last few years.
I think you'd be surprised. I mean, and if you look at something like Jam DeMatteis getting his, you know, DeMatteis verse or whatever he called it, kind of out there in the last couple of years, like he's someone who's definitely like an older creator compared to yourself, like who's, you know, around a lot earlier, and yet, you know, he's was able to generate a lot of support to get those kind of issues out there and to keep it going. And so, I mean, I think it can be done.
It may well be. I honestly don't know. And I'm not willing to roll those dice at this point. Maybe down the road.
So, speaking of prior work, so I'm curious. So, as someone who has a father of a 10-year-old, so my 10-year-old is right now loving your Flash, because I have most of the Flash volumes that DC put out of your work. Unfortunately, I'm missing the Fabled number 6 is impossible to find.
I'm so sorry about that. I know. Even I only have one copy of 6. Yes.
So, I'm curious, Luke, what would you recommend for him to kind of read of yours after Flash and Impulse that would be, you know, well-suited for kind of his age group and for his sensibility as a 10-year-old?
I think Fantastic Four. I think that my run on Fantastic Four with Michael Ringo is probably in that pocket.
Mm-hmm. That's a great one. I definitely own all of those.
And I'm actually looking at my list, my shelf of comps. You know, you don't want to hand him 52. You know, you don't want to hand him Kingdom Come. I mean, maybe, but I think that if you're looking for that pocket, the Captain America stuff, I think, actually is pretty age-appropriate as well.
Yeah.
Those would be my own personal picks. Maybe JLA Year One.
That's a good one. Yeah, I it's funny. Most of the ones you mentioned, I have them all. Actually, it's funny you mentioned 52. We started reading it like two nights ago. I'm like, you know, this could take a while. So, you know, we read an issue a night type of thing. So I'm like, this will last us like 7 weeks, bud. And he's like, really? I'm like, there's 52 issues. Like, I only had I guess the first volume that had 13 issues in it. He's like, oh, there's more than this. I'm like, oh, there's much more.
There's much more than this. Yeah.
Okay, well, excellent. Yeah, I hadn't thought about the Captain America stuff. That'd be good, too. And JLA Year One is definitely a very fun, kind of, as you said, kind of old ages, just fun book. I one thing I've always appreciated about your work is, obviously, sometimes you go serious and you got something like Incorruptible for that, but then you also do have a sense of humor and you do have kind of a lighter touch and you channel what I like to think of as, you know, what comics used to be, is just being more just fun. As they don't always have to be serious. That being said, you do serious very well, because you have a book like Kingdom Come, which is extremely serious but really well done, and so you're able to balance the two very well.
Thank you. I take pride in that. I think that it's I think that a long original graphic novel that has no humor in it whatsoever is deadly to read. I feel like most stories work better if there's at least some moment of lightness here or there to contrast with the darkness. Otherwise, it's just a slow descent into darkness.
So last time when we spoke last year, it was about a year and a half ago, and you were gearing up for World's Finest at the time. And it's fascinating to see how your workload has just expanded exponentially at DC. It's almost like, you know, you've come home and you've really made your home there again. What has it been like to kind of have this DC renaissance of your work? Because obviously you had kind of not been working for DC for some time, and now you're back with a vengeance.
It's great. I mean, they treat me like royalty. I love this. They're very giving, and they are, you know, very open to whatever I want to pitch, and I've, you know, basically they've given me largely carte blanche, as much as you can a freelancer, to do the kind of stories I want to do. And, you know, I get notes like everybody else, because that's what editors do and that's what they're there for. But, you know, they're never, oh, we don't want this story, or don't do this. They're generally more like, you could phrase this better, you know. But other than that, everybody seems to be on board with what I want to do, which is modern comics, but with classic versions of those characters told in a contemporary way.
Mm-hmm. Which one has been the biggest surprise for you just as a writer that you've really maybe enjoyed more than you thought, or you really allowed you to do something that you were jonesing for, maybe didn't realize? Like, which one do you think was the biggest revelation to you?
I think Teen Titans. I think that I kind of always in the back of my head knew I had a Teen Titans book in me somewhere, but it really wasn't planned. It was just based on Dan Moore's kick-ass costume redesigns that made editorial go, keep putting them in World's Finest, and then pitching me on, why don't you do a spinoff book? And once I got into that, once I started breaking that down into issues and having an idea of where I wanted to go with it, man, that ended up being so much fun. I'm on issue 2 just came out last week. I've got issue 5 to do tonight, finish up tonight, and I am just having the time of my life. And Emma Lupacino is an amazing colorist.
Absolutely.
Artist. Jesus.
Artist, yeah. I got you.
Artist. I'm having a moment. But yes.
With a book like that, like, again, because you get to play with, you know, kind of the original Titans, do you approach it in a more fundamental way that you would if you were doing a new Teen Titans kind of thing, because you are dealing with the younger iterations before they go through certain changes?
No, I really wouldn't. It all starts with character. I mean, everything starts with character. Everything starts with how do these two characters, whether it's Speedy and Aqualad or Kid Flash and Robin or Wonder Girl and Bumblebee, how would they interact if they are together? Everything springs from that. And what are the conflicts and what are the similarities and how does that all work? And then stories build out of that. So that's the same approach I take, whether it's Archie Comics or Teen Titans or World's Finest with its guest stars or anything, really. I just start with, here's what I love about these characters. Let me show you.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of, you know, kind of your love of characters, so you did get to do a story in Flash 800, which was kind of a Between the Raindrops kind of story between two issues of your original Impulse run. What was it like kind of being able to go back to very early version of that version of the character and also to work with Todd Knock on that story?
Oh, well, Todd Knock's a great, great artist, and he gets it. I mean, he was perfect for that job. I, you know, when the editor asked me to do a short story for 800, I was very skeptical because, as I've said before, I don't really want to go back and write more Wally stories if I can help it, because I don't want to give people the chance to go, oh, his older stuff was better.
Right. Yeah.
But when I realized I could make it an Impulse story with Flash in it, oh my God, it just wrote it. I mean, it wrote itself. I think it took me an hour and a half to write that story, which is a speed record for me, because it just was all there.
That's awesome. Yeah, it was just great reading, again, this version of Bard and him with Max. And again, you're right, Todd Knock is probably, you know, him, Humberto Ramos, and Michael Ringo are kind of exist in that same kind of pocket where they can, are so expressive and comical, but like not too silly, right? Like, they're cartoony, but just right.
Just right, exactly. Right on the edge of being serious but cartoony, yes.
What is it about Bart that speaks to you?
I built him to be unique. I built him to be unlike any other comic character that I can think about. Certainly in the superhero realm, he speaks to me because he's just straight from thought to deed without pausing in between, which pretty much defines me as well, by the way. And you know, he doesn't. Both Bart and I will have the same thing on our tombstone, which is, he didn't think it through. That's going to be our epitaph. That's what I love about Bart.
In your current work, obviously, you're working a lot with Dan Mora. First of all, how does he have the speed to keep up with you?
God only knows. I have no earthly idea. It's insane.
Like, the level of quality he's pumping out at the clip he is insane. It's really amazing.
He can do 2 pages a day, easy. I mean, my favorite story about him so far is, and this is 100% true, he sent me, every day he'll send me breakdowns, thumbnails, just really rough thumbnails to make sure that, because the potential language barrier you know, which he speaks English, but you know, he's Puerto, he lives in, you know, I'm going to get it wrong. I'm totally going to get it wrong. So I mean, he just lives overseas.
Okay. Safe answer.
God damn it. I'm having a day. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Dan. Regardless, is there any way out of this? Can I buy my way out of here somehow? I don't know.
Just it doesn't matter where he's from. I get what you're saying.
that English is not his first language, and okay. So he is very good at it. But he is, you know, to make sure that there are no hiccups. Mm-hmm. You know, he'll send me like rough thumbnails every morning, and so a couple of weeks ago at 8:12 in the morning, he sent me a thumbnail drawing of a page. At 8:20, I wrote him back and said, "Hey, this is great. You got it." At 10:16, that same morning, he sent me the page, all inked and ready to go. It's insane how fast that guy is.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, yeah, unbelievable.
When did you first become aware of his work?
I knew it from Klaus, mm-hmm. which he was doing at Boom with Grant Morrison, and I liked it. But when the editor paired me with him for World's Finest in that, you know, Detective Comics, a story that we used to sort of launch it, that little one-off that led into World's Finest, I didn't recognize the name. I didn't know the artist off the top of my head. So I went and looked. And I remembered, oh, yes, it's the Klaus guy. This is going to be good. But I had no idea how good he would turn out to be. Mm-hmm. I think the Klaus work is great, but it is what he's doing now is just infinitely better. Just amazing.
I mean, it helps you're giving him great stuff to draw.
Well, sometimes you can say, but, you know, he's phenomenal. I don't know what else to say.
Obviously, as a writer, you have to manage a lot of different things in your head at once because you're writing a lot of different books. Working with him and having a collaboration where you have pages coming in from multiple books, you know, is that a fairly straightforward process in terms of, like, is he working on, like, kind of crisscrossing between books at a time in terms of when you're getting the artwork in? Or how is he managing that to kind of keep himself sane from what you can see?
Hell if I know. by the way, Costa Rica, that's where he lives.
Oh, okay.
For God's sake, Jesus Christ. I'm so sorry. It's been a week. Where was I? So, no, he will, when he works, he will focus in on one book. He will, like, he's doing World's Finest 20 this week, for instance. And so he's doing two pages a day of that, and they come in like clockwork. And when he's done, he'll turn to Shazam, and he'll start doing two pages a day of that. And then he'll turn to whatever else he's doing next, and, you know, fit covers in the meantime. So it's not like I get two pages of this and then one page of that. He's just focused.
Wow. It's just incredible. Because, again, when I saw he was doing Shazam, I'm like, oh, what about World's Finest? I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. He's just going to do both.
I was the same way. I know. How can you do both? Well, it turns out somehow he can. And he has a wife and children and an extended family, all of whom I met. They're wonderful people. I don't know how you – he's not a hermit who lives in a cave somewhere and has nothing else to do but draw.
Incredible.
He's so good.
I know we're almost at our time, so I have to ask, just what was it like, I guess, was it pitched to you, or did you pitch Last Days of Lex Luthor? Because the first issue was just phenomenal.
Thanks. Thank you. It's a good combination. It was many years ago when Black Label had just started. One of the young editors there came to me and said, I want you to pitch a Superman thing for Black Label. And I said, nope. I said, why not? I said, because it'll never be published. It's just I'm not currently in favor of DC Comics. A lot of us aren't. I'm not the flavor of the month. Well, surely you've got an idea. No, I really don't. You must have an idea squirreled away. No, I really don't, because I know it will never be published. So why would I have an idea? Well, just go think about it. And I came home and, goddamn it, you know, I had the idea as soon as I sat down, and I knew it was what I wanted, what I would want to do with the Ultimate Superman book at my disposal. I wanted to be able to do something that was a travelogue throughout the Superman universe, but a story with a real heart to it and a story that asks some harder questions about Superman than you normally get in a mainstream Superman comic. So all this to say, Brian Hitch attached himself to it, still couldn't get it approved. And then, the regime change at DC, and it was suddenly back in favor, and it's approved, and off we are to the races.
What's it like working with Brian at this point? Because obviously, your careers were together earlier, and now it's obviously many years later. What's it like working together now? Is there any difference in terms of how you guys collaborate, or is it much the same?
No, there is a difference, actually, in that he is such an accomplished storyteller in and of himself, and he's become even more so since we worked on JLA all those years ago, that while I still send him full scripts, I leave them plenty open enough for him to, add stuff, subtract stuff, do whatever he thinks, as long as we're both telling the same story. Mm-hmm. I'm on board, and he's not subtracting anything so much as he's adding this moment or that moment. And we'll discuss it, but he's adding to the narrative in a way that he before was basically just, I was treating him like an art robot, which is not the way to do it.
Mm-hmm. For the first issue, is there a particular page or panel that's your favorite?
There's
putting you on the spot.
there's a page where Superman's walking through Kandor with Lex for the first time, and he's explaining why he doesn't spend more time in Kandor, which is an epiphany I had as I was writing that scene.
That's awesome. Anything you can tease us about upcoming work? Again, you're writing Shazam, World's Finest. You're doing the Teen Titans book. I guess it's properly called World's Finest Teen Titans, correct?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then there's also Superman Last Days of Lex Luthor. So what else can you tease us?
I can tease you that there's two more projects coming up. One of them with a former collaborator who I adore and will bring so much heat to the table. But other than that, I can't really say much at this point because we've, it's all in process. Issues are being written, but DC likes to dole this stuff out at their own pace.
True.
If you will.
Do you feel...
By the way, I'll give you 5 more minutes only because I spent that much time dithering over Costa Rica. So take it.
Okay. Well, I guess one question I would have is, do you feel revitalized kind of being back in the DC sandbox? Because, obviously, there's something about that sandbox that's your love. You like Marvel, too, but you're DC.
Yeah. I do love Marvel. But I look back on the last few years of work I did at Marvel, and I don't think there's anything there I would have done differently, and I don't think there's anything there that I did poorly. But, yeah, there is just some spark that came back into my work, some balance that came back into me as I was able to tackle the dream book. I've been saying forever that a Batman Superman World's Finest book would be the absolute perfect job for me. The ultimate golden, the ultimate gold ring. And that is what I'm doing. And I'm the luckiest guy in the world to be able to do something for a living that I would have done for free when I was 10 years old.
Do you find when you're writing World's Finest, do you find it, not that anything is, obviously you're enjoying it, but do you find Batman or Superman more the challenge to write?
Superman's no challenge. So Batman is by default more of a challenge to write. Even then, he's not that much of a challenge to write. The trick to that book is keeping the menaces and the threats in such a, finding that sweet spot for something that can be a problem before both Superman and Batman is harder than you would think. Mm-hmm. The two of them can't take on the Riddler just by himself. That's not a fight. There's got to be more to it than that. And so that is trickier than I thought. And I solved some of that by bringing in the guest stars, because then I get, then the menace of the story is maybe not necessarily the most important thing about it. It's more fun to just bring these characters through, like Metal Men and Metamorpho and whoever.
It is fun. Yeah, it's fun to kind of see the travel through the DC universe and all the different characters you can bring in, because they get exposure that they're not going to get elsewhere.
Right, exactly. And again, there's nothing I love more than taking a dusty Silver Age character that you have only a vague passing knowledge of, unless you're over 40, and dusting them off and just saying, here, this is what I love about this character. Let me show you why I think it's cool.
Now, I'm curious, one thing, I mean, obviously, early on in World's Finest, you have the sidekick to Superman character, who we then have the kind of the reveal of the Magog reveal, which I guess is a spoiler, so I apologize to people. A question about that, because you mentioned before how you don't really want to go back to things or have things compared to other, you know, previous work, but that's a very specific one that kind of lines up with Kingdom Come. So what was your thought process kind of writing that story and knowing that's where you're going?
Well, the thing about that one is that I've had that bullet in the chamber for, 25 years. I've had that bullet in the chamber since we finished Kingdom Come. The idea of the kid sidekick and what happens to him and his relationship with Superman. So a lot of that story was already written in my head. And I've just been looking for a place to tell it. But having told it and then realizing, you know, this is a connection I can expand upon, I think I'm making the right choice by going back to the Kingdom Come world, but not in a sequel sense, and more in a prequel sense, if anything. I mean, we're gonna be dealing with seeing the Kingdom Come characters before we open Kingdom Come, the graphic novel, if you will.
Mm-hmm. I guess that makes it more fresh.
One of the things that led up to it, yeah.
Because that way, you're not trotting, ground you've already gone on, because you're setting yourself up.
I am not forcing Dan Moore to compete with Alex Ross or vice versa. You know, that's the thing too. So
that's true.
You know, the characters are recognizable as the Kingdom Come versions of those characters, but they are not, like, I'm not dealing with like Nightstar and Ibn El-Zafash and the younger characters, mm-hmm. a lot of whom Alex created when he was a kid, and it would be, foul play for me to just try to adopt them for my story. So it's more, here's the stuff that happened before Kingdom Come all blew up.
Gotcha. Last question I'll ask you, because I think I've used up my bonus five.
yep.
So I've seen it written a bunch of places in interviews with you that you described the Superman Black Label book as a spiritual sequel to Birthright. How do you envision that, or like, what do you mean by that? Is it specifically because of the kind of the Smallville origins and playing with young Clark and young Lex in Smallville, or like what? What kind of leads you to frame it that way in your mind?
I framed it that way because it is very much the same Luther and Superman and their history that I did in Birthright. So nothing in Last Days, contradicts that in any way and plays off of it instead. I didn't use the word sequel only because Lin Yu is not drawing it. And so it felt odd to call it a sequel. But it, for all intents and purposes, is a bookend to what we started with Birthright.
Mm. I did like in the first issue, and I guess this is a mild spoiler, but when you have Lex, kind of talking with Superman about, having him save his life and how he's transmitting it everywhere so everyone can know that he's agreed to save this vile criminal, horrible person, which is just a smart way of inverting, like, it's a very classic trope of like, all the villain needs help, so he's going to reach out to the to the hero to save him, but being able to still have Lex twist the knife extra that way felt very apropos of that character.
That was the Black Label twist. That was part of the Black Label twist, which is to say that here's something you've never seen before, which is Superman undertaking a mission that almost everyone on Earth doesn't want him to do. And as you'll see more in issues 2 and 3, what are the philosophical implications of that? How does he deal with being, doing something in a world where even the Justice League is saying, this is not a good idea?
Which definitely puts Superman in a position he's not used to being in, right?
Exactly. And that was the goal.
Absolutely. Well, again, so Mark, thank you so much for being so gracious with your time. I'm glad that we figured out it was Costa Rica that Dan Moore is from.
My apologies to Dan, Costa Rica, and Puerto Rico. Thank you. Jesus Christ. I sound like the most... Tell me I don't sound like the most racist man on Earth when I did that.
No. I don't think so at all.
It was purely a stumble. It was just... I've made it worse. I've given it the Streisand effect. I've made it much worse by talking about it, but...
Fair enough. Well, again, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. The current work you're doing is amazing. My son is enjoying your old work, so, I mean, we're a big... I guess we're a group of weighties here in this house.
That's great. I'm glad to hear.
Excellent.
All right, sir. Until next time.
Until next year, I guess, if we keep this pattern.
You bet.
All right. Thanks so much.
You bet.